There's a picture that turned into a meme. It was four guys who were going for a night out in Birmingham, I think in 2019, and they just arrived there and they asked a passerby to take a photo of them. And it became a famous photo called The Four Lads. And what happened to it was, it's kind of evocative in its own way, but people added their own speech bubbles, they added kind of attitudes, sometimes kind of light humour, you might say, but sometimes worse, kind of attributing whether it's kind of racist or just thick attitudes to these guys, or they didn't understand Brexit or whatever it is that they didn't sort of understand. And then another kind of meme series, you put four heads on there. You could have taken four of the elders, if I'd have had time, four out of our elders' heads and put them on the top there. There's one with Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, Matt Hancock, and someone else, Chris Whitty. So there's a nice little meme of those four, and it just looks mildly amusing to have those guys with those bodies, which most of them don't have, I don't think. What do you think of when you look at those four guys? Because you will think something. You'll instantly look at it and you'll think something, even if it's mild amusement, but you will think something, and you will think something more than that about, I can see the kind of people these are. What do you think about their jobs? What jobs do you think they do? Do you think they're politicians? Do you think they're consultant surgeons? What about their family situations? What do you think they're doing about that? Here's an even harder question. Would you like them in your church? Would you like them in your church? Would you like to be friends with them? Do you think they're clever? Do you think they're thick? Do you think they're likely to become Christians? What do you think they're up to? All of us use appearance as one of the markers of judgments we'll make about people, of whether we will like people, whether we will value people, whether we instantly think they're the kind of people that we might get on with, whether they're the kind of people that might become Christians even. Is that right? Is that reasonable? Is that good? Is that godly? Is that Christ-like? We're going to try and develop that as we go through this morning. And it's under that general title, Racism, a Failure to Love. Racism, classism, culturalism, a failure to love. And we thought so far, just as we're coming to the end of the series, I thought I'd kind of go back to first principles, the definitions. We thought about racism as unfair or harmful, hurtful treatment because somebody belongs to a particular race or ethnicity or class. So, of course, as we said in the first week, unfair and harmful treatment is never good. But racism in particular is unfair treatment because of a particular race, ethnicity, or class. And we had very helpful feedback through the 4 weeks. Most recently, someone just pointed out that it's not just across races that discrimination happens and that some form of racism happens. Sometimes, not just to black, Asian, or Hispanic, or other ethnic groups, or even to white groups, Polish plumbers, or whatever it is. It's not only just across races or cultures, sometimes it's within races or cultures that it happens. Between people of the same race, or the same nation, or sometimes the same culture. You see that in tribal wars that happen in some parts of the world. You saw that to some degree in the slave trade. Obviously, it's a complex subject, the slave trade, and those particularly nations and empires who are involved in it bear the brunt of the responsibility for that. But there was obviously a lot of black slave trading that went on at the same time, people trading in their own sort of brothers and sisters from their own country, as it were, as part of that trade. So don't just think of racism across races. Sometimes it happens within races, where some form of tribalism, and it's not just in the African continent that tribalism happens, it happens in Western cultures too, that there's tribalism within a culture and within a nation, within a race. Someone else pointed out that it's worth thinking about that there's discrimination against, I suppose it is a form of racism, against particular groups. Particularly, they sent me a report of the Gypsy, Romani, Traveller, you have to use those three words, groups. And I think all of us, when we go near a gypsy camp, speak to someone who's from that background, I suppose have a wariness, some of which might be justified, some of which not. But there can be a racism that's definitely happening in our culture generally, but it can be a racism that's happening amongst Christians. So when we're thinking of applications in just a few minutes, don't just narrow yourself down to, okay, I've got the big ticket items, which is sort of racism, you know, across the big race categories in our world, and I'm all right with that. Think about it much more at a local level too, that it might be tribalism within a country, within a culture, within people groups that happen to be in our country, like travellers and so on. So think about it much more sort of broadly, but more in detail as well. And we thought already that it's a much broader and deeper problem than we first thought. It can extend even more, not even to just race, but also to class and culture. We can discriminate against people who like rap music, people who have disabilities, have certain accents, even people who have a certain hair color can be discriminated against. We also thought about the fact that racism is always wrong, and as Mark reminded us, I'll just go through the earlier bits as well. We have a common ancestor in Adam, common image made in the image of God. We thought the second week about God's plan to unite his people from all tribes, nations, tongues, languages under Christ. So racism is wrong within the church because of that. And then thirdly, last week, as Mark reminded us, we're all justified. We're all made right with God in the same way, through faith, not by our merit. So there's no reason for boasting, for discriminating, and there's every reason for humility and being united under Christ. That by way of introduction, I think today, about particularly that failure to love in discrimination and looking especially at James chapter 2. And we're going to just overview the whole chapter really. So from the first 13 verses, we love to welcome everyone into the church. As believers, as those who are against any form of discrimination, we love to welcome everyone into the church. James says right at the head, at the beginning of this chapter, "My brothers and sisters, believers in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ, must not show favoritism. He says, don't discriminate. Don't welcome one more than another. Don't welcome one type of person more than another type of person. Don't show favoritism to a rich person. Don't discriminate against a poor person," he says. And he gives the example. If a man comes in with a gold ring and fine clothes, those class markers that we would say, there are signs of wealth here, don't give them special attention. Don't give them a special seat, a prominent seat, a seat that designates honor in that they're closest perhaps to the speaker. See you guys that are honored at the front here? Don't show favoritism to a rich person, he says. And then he gives the example of a poor man in shabby clothes. They've got all the class markers of we're poor. Don't say to them, just stand there or sit on the floor. You're nothing to me. You're not important. You're not significant. You're only just about welcome here. So just sit down. Of course, James points out the irony that it doesn't make any sense because for many Christians, actually it's the rich who are exploiting them. That was true of the people who James is writing to. Actually, it's pretty much true across the history of the world that it's the rich who are exploiting us. But he says it doesn't make any sense from that point of view. But he says there's a much deeper, more significant issue that doing this is not loving your neighbor. See that in verse 4, "Have you not discriminated amongst yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts?" And then verse 8, "If you really keep the royal law found in Scripture, love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing right. But if you show favoritism, you sin and are convicted by the law as lawbreakers." And what James is saying is, this is serious. This kind of favoritism discrimination is really significant sin. You're actually breaking the royal law. You're breaking, in a sense, what is the summary of the law. Jesus says, what is the law about? It's about loving God and loving our neighbor as ourselves. He says, this is the royal law. This is the essence, the summary of the law. And here at the heart of the law is love. And if you discriminate, you are not showing love and you are sinning. And it's as if you broke all the other commands too. All the ones that perhaps socially you might think are much worse, adultery, unfaithfulness, murder, and so on. The same God who is against those is against this failure to love in discriminating, in showing favoritism. Now, of course, James says you're saved by grace. Mercy wins. You're not convicted. It's not the end for you if you've done this. But he wants them to live as people saved by grace through faith, as we're thinking about last week. Those who are saved by grace through faith need to live lives of love. And it's a response to God's love for us. God has chosen us, those who are poor in the world, to be rich in faith. Those who have been loved by God are to show love to other people. It's the response of wanting to be like him. So, discrimination is a failure to love. Favoritism, which doesn't seem to sound quite so bad, does it? Is a failure to love. Now, it's worth really noting that James doesn't say that it's wrong to observe appearance and make certain assumptions. He doesn't say that's wrong, does he? What he says is wrong is how you respond to that. Almost certainly, the person who looked like a ragged poor person was not impersonating. They were a ragged poor person, someone who didn't have much money, couldn't afford clothes, maybe hadn't eaten very much. And so when we think about this, we don't think, well, we need to switch off our brains. Appearance might tell us something about race and culture and character. It might tell us. But there's one minor and there's one major point. One minor point is that it's not always a good indicator, particularly these days, about race and culture and character. It's not always reliable. You might say, well, by the clothes someone's wearing, you might better judge their profession or their sort of status, their likely sort of professional or non-professional status. My dad was a farmer. He always wore jeans. He never wore jeans socially. Jeans were considered working clothes. And, you know, they're kind of in and out. They're in for children, aren't they? Dungarees. You know, if you turned up somewhere in dungarees, did I say the wrong word? I always say the soft G. It's always wrong. And my family always laugh. There we go. Dungarees with a soft G. Is that right? Dungarees. Okay. Boiler suits. So with the braces and stuff. And he would have considered that a piece of working clothing. But nowadays, particularly for children, dungarees are, I've got it now. Dungarees are, could be a fashion item. Jeans could be a fashion item. I ain't that old, really, but you know, if I think in the early part of my childhood, teenagers' years, you'd kind of have smart jeans, and then there was a fashion in for sort of faded light grey jeans, but never ripped jeans. It was a little bit later when I'm in my sort of 20s that ripped jeans came in and then went out again and came in again. So, those sort of class markers can be quite misleading. Tattoos is a fascinating subject. You know, in the 1800s, you had to be really, really rich to have tattoos. So it was a class marker to say, I am well rich if I had tattoos. Then it became a bit of a kind of circus peculiarity. In the early 20th century, it was a kind of sign that you were a bit of an outcast. And then sort of in the 1990s onwards, it became very mainstream, up to the point where about 30% of people between the age of 25 and 40, 30% of people in the UK have tattoos. So we can be very foolish in making instant judgments about someone's class and character. That's the small point, though. Sorry, there's one more example I was going to give just to connect with the four lads. To say that although in those cases it can be wrong, sometimes it can be right. that the four lads, by the way, said, and it kind of looks like this could be true, they say they drank so much on the train to Birmingham, they can't remember the night out. So there they were standing having their photo taken. They can't even remember it. They were so drunk. Oh, now that confirms your stereotype that you had of them, doesn't it? And sometimes what we see can be right. It can be misleading because fashions change, styles change. People dress in particular ways to make certain messages, even though they're not sort of that kind of person, as it were. But they can sometimes be right. But the question is not the assumptions, it's how we respond to them, how we're going to treat them. That's the big thing. The small thing is, well, maybe we're right and maybe we're wrong as we observe and make assumptions. The big thing is, whether we're right or wrong, where do we go next? We see someone in working clothes. We see someone who looks like they come out of prison. We see someone who looks like they're heading for a drunken night out. We see someone who looks like a stock trader when we eventually get to commuting again. We see someone dressed shabbily. We see someone dressed very expensively. We see the brands that they're wearing. What do we do with that? And the sin is to hurt or to harm. The sin is to show favoritism or to put them at a disadvantage by discriminating against them. The sin is to take those differences to hurt or to harm. And you know, the greatest discrimination is to make someone less welcome to the gospel. The greatest discrimination is to deny someone the gospel, because we look at them. And we look at the four lads and we think, they've got their life sorted. It's the weekend. This is what they do at the weekend. It's the celebration. It's the Friday night experience. They're never going to hear the gospel. They're never going to respond to the gospel. And we would never say, well, we deny someone the gospel. But in practice, sometimes we do. Sometimes we do it by who we tell. Choosing the most deserving, choosing the most attractive to us, choosing the most that we think are likely to believe, choosing the people who we think, well, they might be rather useful in church. If they became a Christian, wouldn't it be great? You ever said that? Wouldn't it be great if they became a Christian because they're A, rich, or B, really bright, or have a charismatic personality, or everybody loves them, or have a wide circle of friends. And we choose who to tell because we think we've got a good discrimination about who should become a Christian. So we choose who to tell. Or who not to tell. But also we discriminate by choosing how we tell. And this is harder for us to sometimes unravel. In the approaches we take in trying to tell people the gospel, whether as an individual chatting with people, or whether it's how we connect with our community as a church, in the way we tell, sometimes it can discriminate. The gospel is words. So we've got to speak words. But there are different ways of speaking words, aren't there? There are different ways of conveying the truth. The gospel is about teaching the Bible. It is, in one sense, that process of reading words, understanding words, explaining words. But sometimes we can turn that into a academic process, which for those of us who've got academic understanding, we relish that, we enjoy that, and it does warm our hearts. It's not as though we're being academic about it. We're loving it, we're lapping it up. But sometimes that conceptual way of looking at things, of taking a truth and then sort of abstracting it and making it an idea and then trying to explain the idea, sometimes that just doesn't connect. And let's be honest, it's not what Jesus did. Jesus tells stories. Jesus is concrete in the way that he puts across profound truth. And it's not to do with intelligence. It's not to say, well, you know, we got sort of middle class intelligence and there's all these working class people out here and people on benefit and they haven't got the intelligence, so we need to dumb down the message. No, it's not about that. It's just about styling. It's just about forms of speech. It's just about the illustrations that you use. It's just about making it concrete. And sometimes we don't do that very well. Sometimes I don't do that very well. You know, sometimes you start off with great intentions, but just because you're kind of around big words, sometimes you just use big words and big ideas and complicated sentences because you've been studying something all week and you just get into it. And sometimes I don't do very well, but sometimes we as a church don't do very well. And we might need to do baby steps. We might need to say, well, I can't reach everybody in Haywards Heath, of all the different classes and cultures and races. I can't cross all the divides, but maybe I can cross a little bit into one. And maybe if I can cross a little bit into one, that person who's reached for Christ can then reach further into that community and that culture. And we need to pray so much that particularly as things open up, that God grants us the opportunity to do that, to reach the unreached. So how do you welcome everyone into this church? Of course, it is slightly academic at the moment in that we're so restricted in what we can do. But just projecting forward a little bit and just thinking about attitudes, how do you welcome everyone into this church? People of a different color, people of a different culture, people of a different class, people of funny accents, people with cheap clothes, people with expensive clothes, people in relationships that you know are not right, in gay relationships, people with learning or physical disabilities, people who have transition to a different gender, and that's obvious. How will you welcome those people into the church and speak the gospel in a way that makes them feel welcome, feel included, feel invited, feel part of, and feel valued? Second point, shorter point, verses 14 to 26. We love to value everyone in the church. So we love to welcome everyone into the church. We love to value everyone in the church. From verse 14 onwards, James is talking about the connection between faith and works in the context of love and saying this is really important, not because you keep the law in order to be justified. No, it's mercy that triumphs in the end over all your sin. No, you don't keep the law to be justified, but you keep the law as a sign that your faith is alive. Otherwise, you just got dead faith. You just got devilish faith that just believes in God. He says you work that out in your actions of belief. And he gives the example, verse 15, another great example that we can instantly relate to. See how well he teaches to people of all different classes? You can all completely connect with this straight away. Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and well fed, but do nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? The language he uses here is someone who is looking like they're in a permanent state of destitution. So when he says a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food, the language is an ongoing, continuous situation, not just a momentary thing. And James says, will you just say a few kind words to them, to a fellow Christian, and say, keep warm and fair, go in peace. It's the word shalom. Some of you who watched the video on Tuesday at the community groups heard the word shalom again, that Jewish word for peace, that Jewish greeting. And they may have used it as a greeting or as a goodbye. When people went, go in peace, they might say. Keep warm and well fed, they add. And James says, this is ridiculous that you're just saying that. It's like saying to someone in our culture, we might not say shalom. We might say, you know, God bless. I'm really praying for you. Someone tells us about their situation and we have the means to help them and we know they haven't got the means to help themselves at this time. And we say, oh, God bless you. I really hope you manage to sort it out. Oh, I'm really praying for you. I'm really, really praying God would provide you with the means. And James says, it's not enough to speak good spiritual words and to talk in grand spiritual phrases while you're seeing your brother and sister go hungry. It's not good just with token gestures and token words. And if we connect that with our topic of discrimination and racism, discrimination is a failure of faith in action. And discrimination within the church, especially, is a failure of faith in action. When we're denying help, when we're denying fellowship, when we're denying inclusion, when we're denying the value of other believers in the church, we're doing just what's said here. We're denying them something. When we're denying that, then it's a failure to love. It's a failure to work out our faith in practice. Mark mentioned last week that sometimes we're unaware of a bias we might have, or a judgment we might be making, or a privilege that we might be taking for granted because of our class or our culture or our race we belong to. And society's answer to that is to give us a bit of training, just give us more knowledge. It's to send us on what someone's called unconscious bias training, which happily I think has recently been discredited by the government. But it's a kind of combination of pseudoscience and secular thinking. And maybe some of it points out usefully some ways in which we have a kind of an unconscious bias here or there. But the heart of it is godless. And actually it's loveless. And if they are asking for equality, there's no moral basis for it. There's no drive for it. There's only self-interest. But you see, what James is telling us is that the reason we get rid of bias and discrimination is because we want to work out our faith in love. We want to love. It's about our hearts wanting to love. And although we do want to value independence, and we don't want to necessarily help everyone out with every problem that they have, sometimes it is good for people to work out how to solve problems themselves. And we don't want to compensate in a foolish way for everyone's disadvantage and say, well, everyone has to be kind of on a level in society and in particular on the church. You know, everyone has to have a go, as it were. We don't say that. There are different giftings, there are different situations, there are different financial circumstances that people are in. There are times when we do need to learn to trust God through a situation and not be bailed out all the time. But sometimes we do need to intervene and we do need to compensate, whether it's for a financial disability, whether it's for an intellectual disability, whether it's for a physical disability. Sometimes we just need to tilt the balance a bit. Because we love. Because we love to value everybody in the church. And we want everyone to thrive in the church. And we want everyone to grow in faith in the church. So how will you show that you value everyone in the church? Whatever their race, whatever their culture, whatever their age, whatever their ability, whatever their class, whatever their intellectual status, whatever their ability or disability. We naturally gravitate towards people like us to some degree. Sometimes the opposite happens, but we often do try and find people like us. And again, just like observing things in people, it's not wrong to do that. It's sometimes perfectly natural if you've got things in common with people, common experiences, people who will perhaps understand what you're going through. They may become some of your first friends, particularly if you come into a church and become part of a church. If you become a Christian and join a church, that will happen. But as mature Christians, as people who grow up and try and work out their faith more and more to try and practice their faith, we want to walk across the room a bit more. We want to branch out more. We want to go beyond that natural affinity with people to say, oh, are we excluding anyone? Not am I friends with everyone. You've got 170 members in this church. You can't be friends with 170 people. But is there anyone being excluded that I could include? Is there anyone missing out? Is there anyone who's not able to express their gifts in the church? We need to sometimes just cross the room. Sometimes we just need to signal to people that they're welcome. Sometimes there's a huddling and a clustering. I know you can't do it now. Sometimes there's a huddling and a clustering that excludes completely unintentionally. There you are. You're talking with a couple of your mates, and it's all fine, and it's all loving, and it's all caring. Maybe you're talking something theological. Perish the thought, that might happen after a Sunday service. But there you are, and you're not excluding anybody. But just your shape is excluding everyone. And you're someone over here who's recently joined the church, or maybe you're from a slightly different class and culture and background, and you're over here and you look at that little group over there and you think, they don't want me there. They don't want me as part of that. And sometimes we just need to compensate, and we just need to open up the circle a little bit and just invite people in. And that happens with conversation groups, but that happens in all sorts of other ways. And again, it's not about you have to welcome everybody. You know, every time you sorry, I just keep chuckling because I keep having to make illustrations that are completely irrevelant because we're in lockdown. But, you know, next time you're going out with someone, it's not say you have to invite the whole church. You know, next time you have a birthday party, you know, you have this real guilt trip in churches, don't you? Like, I'm having a birthday party. Well, but if I invite them, then I don't invite them. It's not to say you have to invite 170 people next time you have a birthday party or some celebration. You know, if you don't invite me, I don't care. It's absolutely fine. But, I might even be pleased. Anyway, the thing is, though, are you excluding somebody from those social gatherings? Is there someone that you know never gets invited to the birthday party, never gets invited to go bowling or to go for a meal or wherever it is you're going, to go to the beach? None of which you can do. Maybe you can go to the beach. The next Zoom party you have, who are you going to exclude? Who are you going to include? It really does matter, and it really does happen. And so, although the illustrations are a little bit weak because of the lives we're living at the moment, it's true that it happens. James could see it. We know it, that sometimes we don't value everyone. We don't always welcome people into the church. We don't always value everyone in the church. And James says, if you've been saved by grace, you will want to love. How will you love people in this church? How will you welcome people in the church, into the church, give them the gospel, invite them in, and how will you value them when they're in the church, whatever their race, whatever their class, whatever their culture? How will you value them? How will you love them? How will you avoid discrimination and favoritism? How will you avoid tokenism, not helping, not sometimes compensating for someone's exclusion, someone's weakness? How will you do that? How will you love?